Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance live from the Kintec Studio. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. The hotline is brought to you by Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning. The first call, the only call. And we will be joined momentarily here by Kevin Woodley from Ingle Magazine and NHL.com once Dom finishes talking his ear off on the phone there. But we'll get Woodley on here momentarily. I have no idea what Dom is doing, having a lengthy conversation with Woodley before he gets him on the show.
He's got a bone to pick with Kevin.
Apparently, he's really getting into it with him. But after we talk to Woodley, we'll have a couple of open segments to wrap up the show. So lots of time to dive in to the Dunbar Lumber text line. We'll do that in the last hour. And I want to make my Canucks-relevant Dan Campbell take to you as well, Drance.
Ooh.
So I know that's right up your alley. So we'll get into that maybe in the next segment as well. But joining us right now, a presentation of White Rock Hyundai, he is Kevin Woodley. Kevin, thanks for doing this, man. How are you?
I'm good. It's been a busy day. It's all good.
Well, thank you for making some time to chat with us. We always appreciate it. And, you know, we'll get into some of the goaltending stuff at some point during our chat here, I'm sure. But I did want to start asking you about Brock Besser, who, of course, gets the hat trick on Saturday, gets to that 30-goal milestone officially for the first time in his NHL career. How much of Brock Besser's season do you think is a result of him being different as a player? How much do you think it's just kind of right place, right time for him as a player with this Canucks team?
You know what? I haven't thought, like, there's a little bit of both, right? Like, put those hands together, as they say. And I haven't thought about waiting how much is what and how much is the other. Like, we've always known that the talent was there, and yet I don't know that it was applied in the same way it is now, right? And we also all know the personal things, right? Like, I think we've all written about it at various points, including this season, as this sort of, like, can you have a breakout when you scored 29 as a rookie?
Mm.
Like, but, you know, it just feels kind of, it feels different. And part of that is, you know, what you mentioned about doing things a little differently. And, you know, the conversations, JT sort of reiterated it post game the other night, sort of similar to a conversation I had with him earlier this year about, you know, when he first got here, like, Brock wasn't really interested in being a net front guy, so to speak. And now not only is he going there, although, you know, it's interesting, like, I think in some, like, not as religiously, right? Not necessarily him, but the power play setup at times has taken him away from there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the power play struggles during that stretch was other guys weren't as effective in that spot as he had been in terms of the way he's managing a goalie's eyes and forcing him to one side and working off some of the shots, and then just also being there to bang in garbage and willing to win those battles in front. So I do think that's an element that has changed. You know, that's more than just narrative. Guys have talked about that being something. He's talked about it. JT's talked about it. And we're seeing, you know, we're seeing him score in different ways than he has in the past. And so the shot remains, and yet he's not reliant on it. And maybe that's the difference between, you know, always pushing up towards 30 and now hitting it, you know, just over halfway through the season, is the goals that, the type of goals that weren't part of his repertoire as often early. And again, part of that is opportunity and role are there now.
You know, you talk about his work in front of the net, and, you know, we saw more examples of that on Saturday, getting the hat trick, and it's something that's really stood out. And, you know, as you say, like, part of it is being asked to go there on the power play. Part of it is the appetite and the mentality to go in front of the net. But there's a technique to it as well, right? And, you know, with your perspective as a goaltending guy, what is it that Besser is doing well to kind of give the goalie such problems? In general, what makes an effective net front player in that regard?
Well, I mean, part of it's still talent. Like, as much as you, you know, can talk about the willingness to go there, that's not quite the same job it was before. Like,
yeah,
you know, guys aren't coming up with 2x4s into your lower back on a consistent basis. But there is still a battle element. But then when you get there, like double deflection, like to get a piece of a shot from Quinn that's already been tipped by Pew Suter, you know, like that's talent, right? Like, you got to be there, but you also have to have skill. I think to me, sort of the learning how to do it, and again, this goes back to conversations with JT about the things he learned from Chris Kreider way back in New York, and Watching Kreider and some of the things that him and Brock talk about, it's goalie's eyes, and it's strategically taking them away or forcing them to certain sides of the net in specific situations, knowing that they have to find the puck and making them make a decision. Are they going to keep looking short side or do they switch to the middle? Can you time it so that, you know, as you push them to a short side, and, you know, like the background here is short side is the preference for most goalies. That's the shortest path for the puck into the net. Most systems are designed for a goalie to find a sight line short side if you have to make that decision. And then you're, whether it's a flexing forward on the PK or your defenseman, like they fill the middle lane. Whether it's purposely as part of your systems and strategy, but also just like there tends to be more bodies in the middle. It's more likely to not get cleanly through the net because of the amount of traffic there. So goalies are trying to look short side. Now, as a screener, do I want to, if I know that and he's looking over my right shoulder on his right post, can I keep moving just a little bit? And force him to make a decision where if he keeps following me to the short side, he's pretty much out of the net. And then if my guys up top are looking for that moment when he switches from, in that case, my right shoulder to try and see over my left shoulder, are you shooting at that instant because he's lost the release? And we talked about this with the people being critical of Demko on the Nylander goal against the Leafs. Everything is about seeing the release for a goaltender. Once you take that away from them, there's a lot of guesswork involved in terms of finding a puck, finding a lane, whether it hits something. Like, it's just all so much harder if you can't see a release. So, you know, that's one part of it, understanding those dynamics and how to push goalies into certain lanes. And then where it gets really cool is to hear the interplay between them, but whether it's Quinn or JT, where, you know, you push them to the short side. Like, I've had goalies in our pro read sessions, like, once that guy gets you far enough to that short side post, you have to make that decision. Part of the thought process is, well, I can go back to the middle here because their guy is standing on the short side post filling that lane now, and he's never going to shoot it at his player. Well, now you've got guys like Brock and JT being like, yeah, if we get him to make that decision, I will shoot it at Brock, and he knows to try and get out of the way because now we've opened up the short side as the goalie shifts. So it's become so hard for goalies because of this interplay. I'm not here to pretend that these guys are the only ones doing it. This is around the league, and it's made it really difficult for goalies to manage traffic. It's, you know, it's like, it's almost like a living, breathing organism, how these power plays will attack goalies and screens and traffic lanes. And I just think that they're a part of that. I don't want to say it's the first time, but certainly I don't recall in the past it being to this degree in terms of the way they're managing and working off goalies and trying to create these lanes and traffic in difficult situations. And Brock's a big part of that with his willingness, yes, but then also his understanding, his hockey smarts of how to manipulate a goalie in that space.
Kevin, Brock himself, by the way, will credit JT a lot, obviously, with improving his work at the net front. But I'm curious to get your take on this. What did you think of Vancouver's rush defense in this last week before the All-Star break?
Thought they gave up a lot more.
Yeah.
You know, I for the longest time, like, them giving up odd man stuff was just didn't happen, right? And, you know, I'd be honest, I didn't run the numbers on what it looks like this last, but it just felt anecdotally, and I think in the Leafs game for sure we saw it. You know, and some of that is, there were times when the lotto line was together, and we talked about this before they were split up, where, you know, again, a lot of the rush problems that plagued this team weren't tied exclusively to an inability to defend the rush. They're tied, and you could go look at the Oilers at the start of this season. Like, yeah, they made systems changes, and yeah, some personnel struggled defending the rush, but they also turned pucks over in areas that led to chances that it didn't matter who was back. You had the other team had numbers because of where you turned the puck over and where guys were relative to those players when they did it, right? You hear a lot about being above the puck. I don't want to say, like, that turned on its ear in any way, shape, or form, but it just feels like we're seeing more of those types of opportunities and did in the last week than maybe we'd gotten used to seeing through, you know, what has been a pretty remarkable first half in that regard.
What did you think of, I'm curious to get your take too. This is mostly me just gut checking my own impressions, but Did you think Merzlikins was robbing the Canucks in the first, or did you think that their chances were maybe a little bit overvalued by some of the public XG?
Ooh, that's also a good one, because I thought he was really good in the first, and yet some of the elements we talk about in terms of, you know, making goalies move and going east-west, and, you know, still, like you know, like I think of the one in particular with Besser.
With his back turned, right? The backhand.
You know, and I'm like, that's a hell of a save. Like, he gets across square and controlled, and yet the fact that Brock's on his backhand and can't one-tee it and sort of delays that, you know, maybe takes some of the sexiness off that scoring chance, for lack of a better term. So, you know, that's
a sexy scoring chance, Kevin.
As a goalie, I probably shouldn't even use phrases like that. But, you know, I have talked in the past about goalies getting horny because they're too eager to go get a shot. So, it's...
Stupid sexy Woodley.
I think there's a little bit of both there, Trent. Like, I thought they created chances, and Merzlikins was better in that first period. But also, they weren't... My guess is they didn't grade out as good as they looked on the eye test for a lot of those reasons.
Now, Connor Hellebuck's been on like a 940 heater since early December, but Demko hasn't been far behind, and yet the betting markets have moved significantly toward Hellebuck as the Vezina favorite over the course of the past few weeks.
Yeah.
Do you think that's reasonable? Does Demko still have a shot at this?
I think he's got a shot at it. I think it's smart of the betting markets to hedge that way. And that's not at all based on goalie performance, not in the slightest. But betting markets take into effect who does the voting, right? Like, general managers, not that anybody's looking at Thatcher Demko, because he's got a body of work. 2 years ago was spectacular. Obviously, we know about the injuries last season. And frankly, at the beginning of last season, just how inept they were defensively. So I don't think this is a Jim Carrey comparison by any stretch of the imagination. But forever since then, they want established, right? Like, I think it cost Luongo early in his career, Vezina's, he should have won, because it was much easier to go with a guy who had been doing it longer in Brodeur. So I get the betting market part. Hellebuck's got one. And the numbers the Jets are producing defensively are remarkable, and goaltenders benefit from that. When you measure individual goalie contribution to team success relative to that environment, Demko still grades out higher, both in terms of expected save percentage and expected goals against.
So
recency bias always all plays into this, right? And a lot of what Thatcher built up was early in the season. And so he probably, to have a chance to unseat Hellebuck, even if his expected save percentage is his save percentage differential is 5 points higher right now, and like top 10, whereas there's a few small samples in there, but like, you know, near top five, whereas Hellebuck's top 10, even with that context, I think he's going to need another hot stretch that gets everybody, whether it's fair or not, I can't say, but he's probably going to need another hot stretch to get back on top of that recency bias and that narrative, even though at this point in the season, he's a full 5 goals above expected better than Connor Hellebuck.
Yeah, the movement doesn't really feel to me like it matches the reality of their seasons.
You know, and there's some numbers in there. Like, Hellebuck's numbers, when Winnipeg is up a goal, they're disgusting. Like, it's absurd, man. Like, out of his 15 goals saved above expected, I think 11 or 12 of them are with the Jets up a goal. And, you know, that points to, you know, some incredible poise as a goaltender. Like, there's a reputation portion of this. And confidence that a team, like, that the rep is real, right? Like, but also, is it Demko's fault that the Canucks tend to be up more than one more often? Right? Like, you're almost, in some ways, you're punishing them because they get up two or three. Whereas Hellebuck's playing under that pressure of only a one-goal lead so much more often because, frankly, the Jets aren't, they've got dynamic parts, but they're not extending leads to the extent the Canucks have, especially in first periods and early this year. So Thatcher hasn't played, you know, there's been plenty of opportunities here in the last little while. Like, you know, the shutout, yeah, like those were tight games where he's had big moments in tight games that we can, like, he's never going to catch up to the cumulative results of the Jets unless the Canucks stop scoring. And so far, we haven't seen many signs of that.
Woodley, I wanted to ask you about what's going on with the LA Kings as well right now, because, you know, I think it was early December, they were tied for the Canucks with points percentage, and then the Canucks have surged. They've fallen off a cliff. Now there's a massive gulf between the two teams in the standings. And early in the season, Cam Talbot was playing really, really well. The Kings were off to this incredible start. How much of what's happening in LA is about Cam Talbot? How much of it is about just the team in general struggling right now?
They go hand in hand, right? Yeah. We could just replace Edmonton's start with Edmonton's current run, like swap the two, right? Like when the Oilers couldn't get a save, and everybody was pointing the goaltending, I kept screaming that they were dead last in the league in high danger chances off the rush, 32nd. Now, you know, Skinner, frankly, since mid-November, has played at a Vezina Trophy level.
Yes,
the start won't let him be in the conversation. But guess what's changed? The Oilers went from dead last to first in the league in terms of high danger chances off the rush that they give up. Like, you can only and the Kings were the opposite. So Talbot with that structure is perfect. I think there was a point where he had a 930 save percentage, and
yeah,
he was at the quarter, he was in the quarter pole Vezina conversation with Demko, right? And when I looked at the adjusted numbers, he was still good relative to environment, but no, like Thatcher was clicking along at like +6.5%. Talbot was +1, which like ranked in the 30s. Like, environment matters. And if you're going to be a team that's going to not spend on goaltending, not invest in having a superstar goaltender because you believe you have the defense to insulate him, and Talbot, to his credit, was outperforming that environment. As long as it's controlled and stable, he's capable of. But as soon as that environment erodes, and it's eroded, and I can't tell you why, whether it's as some of the players themselves suggested, guys chasing stats, trying to get their cookie, as Doughty said the other night when they got out to an early lead, or if, like, we've seen this with McClellan teams too, where they go from being great defensively to not having that defensive discipline or that buy-in from the entire group, those numbers have eroded and Talbot's have gone with it. And so you can chicken and egg it all you want. To me, it only works to do that with your goaltending if you can maintain that environment, and they haven't. And so the goaltending's falling off as well. I'm like, not excusing the goaltending, but I guarantee you don't go into the season saying Cam Talbot's your number one if you were thought you're going to be what they are now defensively. You only do it because you think you have the environment to sort of support it and prop it up. That environment's gone, and it's no longer sustainable for him the way they're playing. So it's not excusing the goaltenders to point to the environment. It's just explaining it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, give him that structure, whether it's Korpisalo last year, Talbot at the start of this year, most goalies are going to have success behind it. Take it away, and now all of a sudden you need heroics in net the way they're defending. And they didn't sign a goalie that's designed to be he's not designed to be an acrobat.
So, Woodley, we're running short on time, but I want to bring this up to you because you talked about Stuart Skinner.
Are you telling me to talk less?
Yeah, sorry, bud.
Never.
To be clear, I just appreciate it when it happens to me as a fellow long-winded dude that people are like, hey, maybe not this time, bud.
Shut this guy up.
I'm just curious to get your take on this because you're talking about Skinner. You're talking about the Edmonton Oilers defensive environment. I was looking at it yesterday, and it occurred to me, and I don't think people are ready or prepared for this, but are you ready for the Connor McDavid should be considered for Selke discourse that's about to unfold?
Ooh. You know what? I'm so focused on the goalies that I don't care what you guys do with yourself. I'm taking the easy way out, Drats, because I don't have an answer for it.
The Selke's fake is to just go to the goalie, right?
Well, no, like, listen. The ironic thing is again, when they suck defensively at the beginning of the year, like, can you be the captain and the top offensive minutes guy on a team that is 32nd against the rush for 6 weeks of the season and still be in consideration for the Selke? If it wasn't you making the turnover, even if it was other players?
I say yes, provided that you then are the key driver of the best defensive team in hockey for the rest of the season.
See, then it's a fair argument. Like, if that's enough, right? Like, because I look at the same way with Skinner. Like, Skinner's played unbelievable. Now, a lot of it is environment, but let's be honest. Most of the people who are doing the voting, half of them, most of them don't have access to the numbers I have. Like, they don't even know how much of it's goalie-related and team environment. Like, they just don't know. And could he get into the Vezina conversation? My answer was no because of those first 6 weeks, and I think that should also be reflected in the Selke. But to your point, it's a fair argument the other way, because as McDavid goes, not just offensively, like, he sets the example. If he's not cheating, if he's backtracking, it's much like the Canucks. You can't just – defense isn't great defensemen. It's all five guys, and your top offensive players have to buy into it to set the stage for everyone else, like Kopitar does in L.A., like Deneau does in L.A. McDavid has done that in Edmonton, and so if – ignoring the first 6 weeks of team results is enough, then yeah, he should be in that conversation. But then maybe I should change my tune about Skinner and the Vezina.
Well, we'll leave it there for now. As Drance mentioned, we got to get to break, but appreciate the insight as always, Woodley. Hope you enjoy a week off from covering the Canucks. We'll talk again soon.
Clearly I'm enjoying it too much already, because I'm like letting my language slip a little there, boys. I'm in way too casual mode. My apologies.
It's all right. We'll deal.
You were on a break.
Yeah. Right. Have a good one, man.
We love you, bud.
That is Kevin Woodley on Sportsnet 650, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George in White Rock or whiterockhyundai.com. All right, we will take a break. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. Get your thoughts and questions about the Canucks in now, and we will continue to look ahead, dig into some of the other rumors that came out about the Canucks and what they might do at the deadline, and also my Dan Campbell and the Canucks take. That's coming up next year on Sportsnet 650.
Catch up on what happened in Vancouver sports with Halford and Brough in the morning. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. I feel bad cutting it off. What a jam.
So good. Daisy Jones and the Six, baby.
Dom.
And if you don't love me now.
Yes.
Your answer?
You will never love me again.
All right. Very good. Welcome back to
Not that you ever did, Dom.
Never make the change.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for?
There's a famous Annie Leibovitz photo of Fleetwood Mac all lying in a bed.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
And someone the other day on Twitter, so you can look it up on Twitter if you want, or on Google if you want the visual, but someone said that it was basically Charlie Brown. who's Willy Wonka? Who visits Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory?
Oh, his name's Charlie.
Yeah.
Is that a bucket?
Yeah,
his last name?
Anyway, they said it was like Charlie from Willy Wonka while he like is working in the child labor factory. Like,
that's what his grandparents are doing. Hanging out in bed.
I legitimately had like a 20-minute laugh over that.
Charlie
earlier.
Bucket.
Charlie
wow.
Bucket. Nailed it. Hey, they've earned the right to rest. They're decrepit and broken, not like Fleetwood Mac.
Big Roll Doll guy over here.
Yeah, I read a lot of Roll Doll.
Yeah, of course.
As a kid. Anyways.
By the way, how many Willy Wonka movies do we need before we all join hands across Canada?
So I saw, apparently, not only has this latest one come out, which blew my mind.
And Timothy Chalamet.
Yes, yeah. That is, it's in theaters. But apparently it's like crushing the box office. It's like,
oh, people are into it.
People have, and it's like, I haven't heard not a single person say, I've seen this, not a single person like on social media say, wow, I really liked it. Like, I've heard nothing about this movie. It's made like $700 million or something.
Hugh Grant is a Oompa Loompa.
What's the thing you always say is a PSYOP? I mean, there's a bunch of things.
Adam Fox, mostly. Adam Fox being better than Quinn Hughes.
This is a psyop. The Willy Wonka 100%. Movie being successful. Pardon me?
The best part about it, though, is the Hugh Grant in French being like, je joue l'Oompa Loompa. He gave a French media interview, and his like, you can tell that his entire acting career, like coming down to this moment, is just like
crushing
looming
him.
In his head, and he's just like, je joue l'Oompa Loompa. And it's just like, oh man, that sucks for you, bud.
That's tough. Tough times for Hugh Grant. Okay. So it's the Canucks bye week, which means we gotta stretch our wings a little bit here to find some things to talk about. And
stretch our wings.
Yeah, whatever. I don't know.
Stretch your legs.
Yeah. Shut up.
Do you stretch your wings? Do birds stretch their wings?
All right, Icarus, how close
to
birds the sun
stretch.
Do you
what do you mean? What do they mean? They're tucked up against their bodies and then they stretch their wings.
I've never
They unfurl
that.
Their wings.
Yeah, unfurl. Okay, sure. Are they
Jamie, you're the wind beneath my wings.
Thank you, Dom.
I think you spread your wings.
Whatever. Close enough. All
pretty
right?
sure. Spread wing postures is what it's called.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
This is some bi-week content.
Right this here. Is peak bi-week content right here. All right. So, watching.
Open. You also can,
you
open,
can open
your
wings. Yeah. No doubt about that. Yep. 100%.
You can flap them.
Spread
anything
your wings.
Else? Definitely. You can definitely flap your wings. You know what? I didn't know enough about it. Oh, apparently birds also use their wings to sun. Hey, stretching! Widespread wings release tension after flying or sleeping. Birds stretch their wings to improve circulation and help their muscles to relax if a bird has been settled in one position for too long. Birds.
Just like us.
They're just like us.
I also stretched when I've been in a position for too long.
Jess was trying to clip your wings.
I was trying to clip your wings, but
yeah.
You were right. Stretch your wings, okay?
That's right.
Fly, let's Jamie, fly.
Fly.
All right.
Well, sorry. His last name's Dodd. You can legitimately use the John Glenn quote from Hunt for Red October, which is fly, big D, fly.
All right. Are we going to do this?
Referring to the USS Dallas, of course.
Yes.
Stretch your wings, baby.
So.
How many times have you seen that movie?
like once. I'm more of a Crimson Tide guy.
What?
Roll Tide.
Yes, Roll Tide. Indeed.
Roll Tide. My goodness. Okay,
me
sorry.
And Nick Saban, big Crimson Tide guys.
Sorry, I've interfered with you stretching your wings.
I mean, I don't really care. We got to fill the time somehow, so it's fine. This is as good as anything we're going to do. But anyways.
I'm just squirreling the segment.
Watching Conference Championship Weekend, as I know, of course, you were. Speaking of being in one position for a long time, I know you were there on the couch watching NFL's Conference Championship Weekend and watching the Lions lose to the 49ers.
What do you mean you know I watched the games?
I was sneaking suspicion.
Yeah, you're right.
Watching the Lions lose to the 49ers in the NFC edition, but then also watching the dreaded discourse.
The discourse was bad.
Happen after and still happen today, right? And if you didn't watch the games, here's what it is. Dan Campbell coached the Detroit Lions up big. They have two fourth and short calls. I think it was a fourth and two and a fourth and three.
Arguably three because there was also the one before the half.
That's fair. But anyways, the two really in focus. Fourth and two and fourth and three. One with a chance to kick a field goal to go up 17 points. Of course, make it a three-score game. They go for it. Don't get it. Late in the game, or in the fourth quarter at least, a chance to kick to tie the game. But they go for it to try to extend it and try to score to take the lead.
And they lose by a field goal is an important part
they
of
this. They lose 34 to 31.
Yeah.
Ultimately. Now, obviously, this brings out the, oh my gosh, what was Dan Campbell thinking? How do you not kick to make it a three-score game? What? Analytics run amok in the NFL. And that's a whole other side of it that I think is just completely ridiculous that maybe we can get into. The idea that this has like anything to do with analytics and Dan Campbell. But what it reinforced for me, and I'm always a little surprised and disappointed, but then I remember, oh yeah, I knew this, is that a lot of people in sports, people who work in sports, people who coach, people who play, people who broadcast, people who are fans,
people who watch,
are fundamentally scared. They're scared to compete, as Logan Roy would say, right? Because, yeah, you know what Dan Campbell wasn't going to do? He wasn't going to play it safe. And that's fine. If you're only worried about minimizing risk and not making yourself look bad, then yeah, you go out there and you trot your field goal kicker out there. And even if he has a bad record, a really bad record, on kicks from that distance, if he misses,
as their kicker does,
everyone is blaming the kicker and no one is blaming the coach. And you can successfully avoid blame for those things. But it actually reminded me a lot of what Jim Rutherford had to say when he was giving his press conference after signing an extension with the Canucks about the risks of going for it at the deadline and the risks of not going for it at the deadline. We focus so much on the risks of the aggressive decision, or what is perceived as the aggressive decision, right? Oh my goodness. Oh, what's going to happen? If you don't get it, you're going to give them so much momentum and your players will be so discouraged. Oh no, you can't do it. You got to play it safe. Oh, it's so scary to go for it. But nobody ever takes into account the risks of not going for it, of not being aggressive, right? And I think in Dan Campbell's case, when you think of the Detroit Lions, how did they get to the NFC Championship game? They got there by, from the moment Dan Campbell got hired in Detroit, he's made it his MO to be aggressive, to have that swagger, to have that confidence. You're telling me biggest game of the year, biggest game the Detroit Lions have been in decades? And he goes out and completely changes his mindset that that's not going to have a negative effect on his players. Biggest play call of the year, and all of a sudden he decides to start coaching scared. And you think the players are going to be fine with that? It's like, oh, okay, that's fine. Yeah, we've done it this way for multiple seasons now in a row. It's gotten us here. But yeah, whatever. Let's just be really, really conservative and safe from this point on. That's a tremendous risk to take at that point in the game. Yeah, look, it didn't work out because there's no foolproof way to win on the road as a significant underdog in the NFL playoffs. There's always going to be risk. There's always going to be downside, but you can't look at it just because one of the risks materialized and say, well, therefore it was the wrong decision. And it reminds me a lot about the way some people talk about it in this market with the Canucks, where it's, you know, look at Boston last year. They made those big trades and they lost in the first round. And what if you make a trade and it upsets player chemistry, where you're really going to regret it? Or what if you lose in the first round? We always look at the potential downsides to try to justify the timid, the conservative approach. We never think about the potential downsides of the conservative approach. We never think about the potential upside of the aggressive approach. And, you know, Dan Campbell, I thought, to his credit, said after the game, I don't regret those decisions. I think that's exactly right. That's the exact attitude he has to have. And I think Jim Rutherford, as we've heard from him, he has an MO. It's being aggressive. It's recognizing when he has a shot to go for it and going for it. I think he's going to do that. And I don't think he's going to regret the decision if it doesn't work out either. Well, and he shouldn't.
He said specifically he wouldn't. Now, yeah. The thing is, to illustrate your point better, right? Who was the winning coach on Sunday in that game? Kyle Shanahan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't know how many people will remember this, but the 49ers 4 years ago, right before the pandemic, actually, blew a massive lead to the Kansas City Chiefs team that they'll play again. And on their very first drive, right, from a 4th and 5 from the Chiefs' 20-yard line, Shanahan kicked. Quote, unquote, took the points as if nothing can go wrong on a field goal attempt.
Mm-hmm.
Then, with the Chiefs driving inside the 2-minute warning at the end of the first half, Shanahan didn't use his timeouts. So when the Chiefs turned it over, he only had 59 seconds to score. They sort of go into the half tied 10-10. Then he kicks a field goal on a 4th and 2nd from the Chiefs 24 to go up 13-10, right? They end up building a lead and they end up blowing the lead and losing the Super Bowl. Now, those are all the conservative calls, right? Those are all the calls that no one second guesses, really. But they can also contribute to a loss. They can also contribute to how a team blows a big lead. Fact of the matter is that a overthrown ball bouncing off a defender's face
seriously.
Into Brandon Ayuk's, a great play by Brandon Ayuk, by the way, a fumble by Jahmyr Gibbs, and in particular, I mean, two Justin Reynolds drops, one on a 3rd down conversion attempt, one on a 4th down conversion attempt, one of the two that people are second guessing. Like, that's the game. That's it. You know, like, those are the biggest plays in the game, the plays that really swung it. I don't know. The second Dan Campbell decision to go for it, for me, was, like, dicey. The first one was a no-brainer, in my opinion. And yet, if you rely on the data will tell you that those are basically 50-50s.
Yep.
It's coach's decision. So
I just that's a separate part from the Canucks take, really, because I don't think really an analytics angle to the Canucks decision to go for it.
No, but I think,
or, you know what I mean?
I think the key thing is like, for me anyway, and to bring it back to the Canucks, we use data for a variety of things in sports. I lean on it really heavily because it's what I understand in some ways better than, you know, for example, like how to shoot around a screener short right. side to create a sense of additional traffic against a goalie and turn a 8% shot into a 12% shot the way like someone like JT Miller, one of the smartest guys in the league at doing stuff like that, does, right? Like, I'm not going to come on the radio and pretend to talk about the game at that level. I don't see the game at that level. I never will. But I do understand regression and basic numbers and how they apply to hockey and, you know, how they apply to player evaluation or can. Ultimately, though, data should never be viewed as being independent of the decision maker,
mm-hmm.
right? And when it comes to the Canucks at the deadline and these risks here, you know, we evaluate tendencies. We know Rutherford's tendencies are yep. to be super aggressive, star level veteran forward, right? Like, that's sort of been my calling card for the Canucks. But, you know, and to sort of bring it wider angle lens, talking about this market in particular, the names that, for example, Friedman was linking to the Canucks on his merit kit earlier, it's like Gensel, Lindholm, Henrique, like none of those guys are Phil Kessel. None of those guys are Doug Weight. You know what I mean? Like, in a lot of ways, when you look at the players that are, you know, dotting Saravalli's trade board or Chris Johnson's trade board at The Athletic, like, you're not going to come across a lot of quality.
Not at the high end.
Does that impact, in your view, how the Canucks should individually, Canucks decision makers should individually sort of use data, history, et cetera, to inform their view of the risks at hand?
Yeah, I mean, you have to,
right?
Like, because you can, you know, to say that you should go all in does not mean that you throw cost out the window when you're going to acquire a player, right? If you're going to spend a major asset, it still has to be for a player who is worth that asset. So, yes, ultimately, like, and I mean, we've talked about this a lot. I don't think the 2024 first rounder, like, I could see spending that on a rental because it's not going to be a particularly high pick. And as you said, the draft class isn't shaping up to be as strong as last year's as well. So, you know, that is fairly easy for me to understand parting with. If you start talking about Lekkerimäki or Verlander, then yeah, I don't see a rental out there where that makes sense. Maybe Jake Gensel, because I really, really like Gensel. But yeah, the cost has to match what you're getting back. And I do think it's an open question of, okay, it's one thing to say we want to add an impact top six player. Is that player going to be on the market? Because even Jake Gensel, there's no guarantee that he's going to be traded.
No.
I mean, there's no guarantee that any of these guys are going to be traded, but Lindholm and Henrique would feel like pretty strong possibilities. Gensel is really just speculation at this point. And if he's not out there, and then all of a sudden other teams are lining up to drive up the bidding for Henrique or Lindholm as well, I agree, it probably does change the math. But to me, deciding not to go for it because the talent isn't there, right? Or the right piece isn't there. That's very different than just being afraid of the downside. You know what I mean? Which I think is the mentality that so many people get stuck in. And so many people, when we hear the objections to the idea of the Canucks making a trade, right? It's just this preoccupation with the potential risks and the potential downsides and the way it can go bad, rather than looking at the ways it could help the team. And you know, just on Dan Campbell and the Lions again, one of the things that people always say when we're talking about these, you know, analytics-driven decisions, right, is, hey, it can't just be about the numbers. You have to look at the context of the game, your team, the opposition, all of that, which, by the way, I think is 100% true. But I think that's what Dan Campbell was doing in those instances, right? He was like, I like our team. I think we had a good chance to move the ball in those situations. I was worried about what would happen if we gave the ball back to the 49ers. Like, he was taking all of those kind of soft things into consideration when he was making that decision. And I think the same thing holds true for the Canucks, is you look at this and you look at, okay, what if the Canucks don't make a move at the deadline? What message is that going to send to the team? And I think that that would undeniably be a more negative message than trading somebody and upsetting the chemistry on this team.
Well, and then there's the, you know, part of what we're talking about with risk and fear, right, is like the managing for optics, the managing, you know what I mean, for your job sort of thing. Now, the Canucks extended Rutherford recently. We expect Alvin to be extended shortly. Like, you know, I think in some ways getting that sewn up when the Canucks did matters, in part because of this, right? We strongly suspect, based off of, in particular, how favorable Vancouver's shooting and save mm-hmm. percentage have been, right? we should strongly expect that it would be very difficult for the Canucks to maintain their current pace over the balance of the season, even if the team materially improves, right? That's also partly based off the fact that their schedule is going to get more difficult, right? Now, that's not to... I'm not casting shade at what the Canucks have accomplished so much as I'm just pointing out, like, if the Canucks were to maintain the pace they're currently on, right, they'd be, what, a... Well, a very, like, 119-point team. Okay?
So not bad.
All I'm saying is we're betting the under on 118.5, which, by the way, I'm sure Vegas would give you a very, very favorable odds on if you wanted to bet the over on that, right? So that's all I'm saying. Now, if you upgrade this team and, like, meaningfully move the needle on their true talent level, you know, you're still... widely likely, NHL history tells us, to finish at like 110 points, 108 points, right? Like, to finish at a level where you lose more games over the balance of the season than you have to this point. And then is the conversation focused on, now presumably they'd need to dip pretty significantly for this, but does the conversation get focused on things like, have they interfered with chemistry, right? Or if you don't, did the players get discouraged about what you did at the deadline? Like, the risk comes on all sides. And it's worth pointing out, by the way, this is per Dom Lecision's model. Games played to date, opponents projected points for the Canucks, 88. That's tied with Colorado, Boston for the softest schedule to this point in the season. Over the balance of the season, opponent projected points is going to go up to 94, right? That's going to be the fourth hardest schedule in the league over the balance, to further illustrate my point, right? Like, it's going to be really hard for the Canucks to maintain this pace because this pace is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And if they do, they're like a historically good regular season team, which, be great for us to cover and talk about. My point being, how does that, like, expected reversion to the mean effectively of this team's performance, how does that interact too with what they do or don't at the deadline?
So you're saying, like, whatever they either do or don't, if they do slow down a little bit, it's going to be connected to that decision?
It could be.
I think it would have to be a very dramatic slowdown. You know what I mean? I don't think going from even, what are you, they're on like 118 point pace to even like 102 point pace is going to seem that jarring.
If they win 3-10 at one point, even if it's like 8 points in 10 games, you know what I mean? Like, that's not going to kill them by any means, right? They can afford that and still win the division.
Yeah, well, 100%.
They can afford that and still win the division without it being particularly, without game 80 against the Oilers mattering potentially. So, I'm serious.
It's true.
Their lead is wild.
I don't know. I don't let that. I don't let that affect my decision making.
No,
like, you got to try.
Nor should this front office.
You got to try to make
your
team the best.
But it will impact the discourse.
It will, 100%.
Yeah,
and that's fine. But, like, they can't worry about that, and I don't think they are going to worry about.
No,
that.
I don't either.
They're going to try to put their best foot forward.
But we should be.
we should be trying to get out in front of it.
Well, just as discoursers, we should be prepared for it, because to do that take
discoursers,
to do that take, you know what I mean, will be the same as backseat driving Dan Campbell.
Yeah. They're going to trade for Jake Guentzel, and then he's going to have like 40 shots on goal and one goal. And they're like, oh, a super cold slump. And everyone's gonna be like, oh, why they give up this much for this guy?
Yeah.
Still be a good trade.
By the way, a Twitter follower of mine, or a guy I interact with on Twitter named Bruce Betts, pointed out to me this. The Canucks and Oilers, okay, the next day that they will end the day with the same number of games played is April 15th.
Wow.
Okay. The gap won't even get to two until March 24th. The Oilers will always have more than two games in hand on the Canucks through March 24th, and it will get as high as six in February.
So the Canucks will have six more games played than Evan? That's wild.
It's going to take a long time for these teams to sort of come together and have the same number of games played, which is why we really got to focus on point percentage in handicapping this. I'm not going to call it race, but potential race.
Potential race. It is wild that the Oilers have won 16 in a row and are that far behind the Canucks still. And I know even with the game, in the games in hand, it gets a lot closer, but it's still a lead. It's still a significant lead. It is truly wild.
I mean, it's a... Even Dom's model projects it as a 3-point gap, which is, you know, not immaterial at this point in the season. Like, a 3-point gap in projected points is big.
Yeah.
Especially given that the model sees the Oilers as the best true talent team in the league.
And probably far and away the favorite to win the Stanley Cup at this point.
Oh, yeah. 5% better Stanley Cup odds than any other team.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, we'll take a break here on Canucks Talk. Coming up, we'll dive into the inbox. Lots of good texts coming in. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, so you can get your thoughts in. Final segment of the show up next here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We are live from the Kintech studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com.
Whose world is this?
All right. I enjoy the music on the show. You really enjoy the music on the show, Dom.
It's a big part of what I do here.
I guess. I mean, you're the one who chose it.
And, you know, Drance and I have our bits.
That's true.
Bits and bites.
Nothing like a good bit.
We also...
Kibbles.
Kibbles and bits.
Big cat energy.
Big cat energy. I definitely have big cat energy, by the way. Big time.
Like, big cat as in, like, a lion, or, like, a big house cat?
A big house cat.
Look, he's got whiskers.
I got whiskers.
Because big cat energy can mean two wildly different things.
Yeah, no. Well, no. Big cat.
I'm the king of the jungle. Or I'm, like, a cat who lies in the sun.
Or you like the Broadway show.
Yeah. Big cats guy.
McCavity has big cat energy. Or you could be hawking Frostiflix. You could have
The Tiger. Tony the Tiger energy. Yeah. Yep.
Which I also don't have. That's like way cool. I've way too cool for me. Nice. Nicely done. Dom's contributions today on point.
Absolutely on
Except
fire.
for him getting mad at me for my train sounds.
No, wasn't like mad. Mad is not the right word.
You just thought it was corny.
It was corny.
I mean, it was corny. Of course it was corny.
We're doing sports talk, man.
Radio!
Yeah.
Okay, so you were... I wanted to pick up on a point you were making in that last segment about... Okay, yeah, it's one thing to agree in theory that the Canucks are in a position where it's worth going forward, it's worth investing, but... The more you look at the rental market, the more concerns you have about the wisdom of that, or at least how much they should be willing to invest in some of those rental players. And, you know, I will confess, like, I've been on the Elias Lindholm bandwagon for sure. I do think, like, the more I dig into a little bit about how he's performing this year, I'm starting to get more wary of that, especially given what he could cost as one of the premier players on the market. I'm not saying I wouldn't do it. I just, you know, a little more trepidation than I had a couple of weeks ago. I think I'm still all the way there with Jake Guentzel, though, in terms of I don't care if it is a rental, go out, get that player because they'd be a perfect fit. Where are you and just in the idea of the rental market in general for the Canucks?
Yeah, I'm down on it. Guentzel, you're right, sort of comes in at a slightly different clip in my view. Like, he's just a better player. Then, in my view, the Lindholm Henrique also belong in different tiers. But
yes,
you know, I don't know that Henrique is an upgrade on Pugh Suter, and in fact, I would fade the idea that he is. Right, Elias Lindholm is definitely an upgrade over all but three players in the Canucks' top six. Right, I feel confident about saying that, but. I don't know that he's like a top-of-the-line driver You know, Gensel is a meaningful driver. I mean, Gensel, I think, could bring a Garland-like impact to the top six, and man, that could that would be useful, right? So yeah, I mean, that's a piece to pay for, in my view. But given that he's expiring, given that he's 29, you know, I don't know that you should be giving up Volander or Lekkerimäki, especially because I think you need to be really protective of this three-year stretch, which includes this playoff run and two more, where you've got this Demko-Hughes axis at $12 million, right? Like, that's the spine, given the fact that, you know, JT Miller's 30, will be 31 come the playoffs, and Elias Pettersson's, there's uncertainty about his cost at least, right? And uncertainty around Filip Ronick's, like, with Hughes, Demko, you've got two elite performers, locked in, highly efficient cap hits. That's the spine of this team's contention window, in my view. And I'm on board, given what this team has accomplished thus far, with them pushing assets in to like take a shot one of those 3 years. But I think you have to be really careful about taking a one-year shot that might harm what you can do in like year three of that, especially with the dynamic of like that season, you know, Miller's going to be 33 for the playoffs and OEL is going to cost 4.5 against the cap, right? Like if you have a Volander, even if he's just a third pair guy in your lineup that season, that's huge, especially on an entry level deal. If you have Lekkerimäki and he's a 20 goal scorer, like if he's playing on your middle six, even, on an entry-level deal, like that's huge. Those are the sorts of things that can help put you over the top in those seasons. I do think you have to be protective of that, and that's why if you're going to spend, if you're going to pay retail prices, which you're going to do anyway for a rental, I'd love to see the team use this as an opportunity to buy, like to buy for a multi-year piece. It's why like a Pavel Buchnevich, if St. Louis decides to sell, and St. Louis is pretty aggressive about selling in years they don't have a cup shot. Now, they've won a lot of games the last week. They're sort of trending in an interesting direction here to make a push for that eighth and final spot. But we've seen Doug Armstrong in the past on years, like even the year right before they won the cup, where he sold. We saw them last year sell, and they weren't dead in the water. But he sold Tarasenko. He sold one other piece, Ryan O'Reilly, netted a couple firsts. You know, if they were to sell a player like Buchnevich and then you've got a guy to stabilize your top six for this year and next, you know, that's the sort of ad that I think is like a far, far greater EV. Like that'll add more enterprise value. That's the sort of bet that I think now we don't see a lot of names like that linked to the team in rumor reporting, in part because teams don't make those decisions lightly, right? Like,
yeah, not necessarily early either, right? Like, for as much as we talk about Jim Rutherford and how he likes to get ahead of the market, there has to be a trading partner out there. And if you're the Blues, and as you said, you're still hanging around the fringes of this Western Conference playoff race and you're playing a little better, your outlook on Buchnevich could look entirely different a month from now than it does right now.
Especially because, you know, in 4 months, you might be trying to extend him.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a relationship management angle to consider here, too. But, like, this is the Filip Ronick thing, where Filip Ronick sort of came out completely out of left field. It's not like that was a name rumored to be available, but a team made a decision to change tack with a specific player, and so they shake loose. Like, that's the sort of opportunity that I'd like to see the Canucks wait on court.
Yeah.
You know?
It's an interesting tension between the benefits of doing it early and getting your business done early, which, as we've talked a lot about, Jim Rutherford has liked to do historically, and there are reasons for that. You know, you try to get ahead of the market, you give the guy more time to gel, you run less risk of another team swooping in and getting your target. But as you said, there's also benefits to waiting, which is that if you're not over the moon about any of the names that are currently available, you don't know what's going to happen between now and the trade deadline. That's still a lot of room to run here, a lot of race to run, and see which other guys could become available.
Yeah, and like one guy, you know, who was in a lot of rumors a year ago and this past offseason, and then it's been quiet around them, and this team's probably at like a fringe contender level. The Carolina Hurricanes have both Brett Pesce and Brady Shea expiring, right? I far prefer Pesce, so does the league. But, like, that's a guy who, if, you know, first of all, Rutherford was involved, like, he was drafted during Rutherford's tenure there. He's a right-handed monster, two-way monster. You know, if that was the sort of player who he was going to shake loose, and if you were giving up assets to get him, and you'd probably have to surrender some contractual money to do it, you could talk extension with him beforehand.
Yeah.
You know, and then, I mean, if you're rolling out a Hughes, Hronek, Pesci blue line for the next 3 years, I think you're really happy. Like, I think you've got one of the best blue line groups in hockey, right? And you can do weird stuff with it. Like, you could play Hughes, Pesci, holding a lead. You could do all sorts of different things. That, to me, would be, like, the sort of big swing where all of a sudden, if you're discussing one of Vancouver's top prospects, if you're talking about a first and a player off the roster, you know, in my mind anyway, that's where you start to sort of consider those items, right? If you're acquiring Chris Tanev, I think Volander and Lekarimäki have to be, like, well off the table. But if you've got a shot to do, you know, like Mackenzie Weegar, right, then that's a different discussion.
Yeah.
You know?
Love Mackenzie Weegar.
Yeah, I'm a little worried about that contract. He's already 30, but you know what I'm saying. Like, if it's a multi-year piece.
But I think that's actually a really interesting point, is targeting a player that a team is motivated to move because they're worried about the contract, but you want them for the next 3 years.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because that helps to keep a price down. Like, I don't know that you'd have to give up Lekarimäki or Volander
to get Weegar.
Mackenzie Weegar because of that contract. I know you've brought up Colton Parayko in the past as well, right? And that contract is scary. But if you are primarily focused on this year and the next couple of years, like, that's one way to get the player with term, but without paying an arm and a leg for it. You know what I mean? Because a lot of these players, and somebody texted it in, would you pay whatever it costs to go get Travis Konecny? We've talked about Travis Konecny.
Yes.
I think you made him your first pick. Right?
Yes. I mean,
the answer is 100%, except that he is in that contractual sweet spot where he's not making too much. He doesn't have too much term. He just, like, he's not a rental, but he's not a long-term commitment that scares you. So he's going to be extraordinarily expensive. You know what I mean? And that doesn't mean don't go get him if he's available. He's a really good player. But there's actually, I think, for a team in the Canucks position, if you were prioritizing the next 2 or 3 years, you can actually be better off looking at a Weegar or a Parayko, because it brings the price down, because teams are scared of their contractual commitments, which is not the case with Konecny.
Yeah, and, you know, I think what you're talking about makes some sense, but the general idea, like, the Zegras, Konecny, like, Pesci, that tier of guy, you can throw Casey Mittelstadt into that group as well. You know, like, Nashville's a team I'm curious to see what they do, because they're very much at the start of, like, a multi-year exercise here, right? Like, a guy like North Vancouver's Colton Sissons, right? Right-handed, wins, draws, center, like, can play center, can play forward, killer penalty kill guy, right? 2.8 or something for the next 3 years.
Yeah, that's a depth, more of a depth add.
More of a depth add.
Yeah, although
sure.
Doesn't that kind of have the flavor of, like, one of the Tampa,
yeah,
trade additions? You know what I mean? Like,
I'm
Gaudreau, or
I'm cool with that. Like, if you can find your answer to Brandon Hagel, like, that's worth paying a premium for, right? If you, the multi-year run guys are the guys that I think this team should be really aggressive in pursuing. And the rental market guys are guys where I think there's at least a little bit of buyer beware, even at the level of a Jake Guentzel, just given that, especially the Volander, Lekarimäki pieces are guys who you could realistically see helping this team extend this window.
Yeah.
You know, in the, like, final years of Hughes's deal, in the years where the OEL buyout is most onerous, right? Like, those are pieces that can, you know, be like what Brandon Saad and Andrew Shaw were to that Blackhawks window, where you got two middle six contributors on ELCs who were making a difference for you in the playoffs. And all of a sudden, the fact that Taves, Kane, Keith, and Seabrook all got way more expensive all at the same time was something the team could manage, right? Like, that, if you're trading one of your best pieces, especially those guys, you really need to be protective, I think, of the latter stages of what I see as, like, a relatively present and relatively brief competitive window.
This text comes in along the lines of looking for impact players with a little bit of term. Would the Canucks ever consider absolutely loading up on D, trading whatever it takes, or he says, you know, Kuzmenko first prospects to get Jacob Chychrun, who's at 4.6 for two more years. It's an interesting name. They're so loaded on the left side of the blue line right now, and obviously, you know, maybe to do this move, you consider trading one or two of those pieces, but I'm not, like, does Chychrun move the needle enough for you to be kind of that type of target in terms of guy you go out because he's that high-level impact player?
I'm a huge Chychrun fan when he's in the lineup. Mm. Like, the thing that scares me about Chychrun is the availability. You know, like, yeah. I think Chychrun's, when he's healthy, his athleticism and his shot, like, he's such a good shooter, man. He's such a dangerous shooter from the point, which also does sort of posit, like, would the Canucks be well-suited to use him best, given that he'll right. never play PP1?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of his value is tied up in that, in my mind anyway. I mean, this is a guy who scored 14 power play goals in the 56-game season.
That's unreal.
Oh, sorry. That's five. 14.
14 goals.
Power play points.
Yeah.
But
okay.
18 goals
yeah.
in 56 games. I mean, he's a sick shooter. But, you know, the like his games played over the last few years, like 48, 47. You know what I mean? Like
mm-hmm.
45 this year. He's missed some with injury, although not too many. You know, really good player. Really good player. I think fringe star level guy. But, you know, I don't know if he... Yes. I mean, short answer, yes. If you can get Chychrun and the price is right, go do it. He's really good.
Yeah. And I guess, is that the type of...
It's just risky because he does have a lengthy injury history.
Yeah, but I guess if you're looking at it as, okay, can we get availability out of him for the playoffs,
mm-hmm.
right? And then, okay, hey, maybe he's injured next year, but we don't... That's less concern if we at least get him for this playoff run, although... Betting on a guy with an injury history going into the playoffs is a little nerve-wracking as well, I think.
What about Claude Giroux as the Doug Weight answer?
That's an interesting one.
Right? Like, as the analogy for what Doug Weight was for the Carolina Hurricanes, Claude Giroux.
My question about Claude Giroux...
2 years left, 6.5.
...is, and I don't necessarily have an answer for this, but my concern about this profile of player is... What's the state of their two-way game at this point in his career?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because I think that's such a priority for me, is to have somebody, to get somebody that really bolsters your top six in a way, you know, you don't have to manage their minutes. You don't have to hide them. You don't have to be really concerned like, oh, no, we can't get them out there against these players. They need to be on the power play to produce. Like, you want somebody who's going to be an even strength beast for you. Is that Claude Giroux right now at this stage of his career? That's my question. I mean, in terms of the pedigree, and his point production is still there, you know, 79 last year, 41 in 45 games this year. Like, he's still a phenomenally talented player, and his career resume says it all. It's just, are you paying a premium for somebody who's like more of an offense-only guy at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so. I think there's some defense to his game. I don't know. I don't love the fit, personally.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little skeptical of the fit, but, you know, that would be an interesting one if he decides to move, or if him and the team, because he's got a full NMC. But he's got 2 years left at 6.5, especially if there was some retention involved, right? I mean, that's... an intriguing one, right? And that would be in line with, like, established star forward.
Yeah, name option.
Plus, it would give the Canucks just a filthy, filthy power play.
Yes.
Could you imagine? Like, because he's one of the, you know, if I often say JT Miller's one of the smartest players I've ever seen operate on the power play. You know, Kucherov, McDavid, like, Giroux's a tier below, but he's a tier below.
Mm.
You know, he's an unbelievable, like, an absolute... geometric genius 5-on-4.
Yeah, because the other name, in terms of like name brand players, which I think is fair to look at given Jim Rutherford's history,
yep.
You know, Giroux fits that mold. A lot of people have texted in about Vladimir Tarasenko, but like I'm talking about the concerns about being offense only. That's even more a magnified concern with Vladimir Tarasenko. And of course, we also hear from Friedman that they're looking for that positional versatility, which Tarasenko doesn't bring. So I get it from a certain perspective because, hey, bet on talent, bet on that name brand. But it just doesn't seem to fit. I mean, you're trying to replace a guy who's really, really offensively talented but doesn't do the two-way things you want, right? So like priority number one has to be find a guy who does those two-way things that we want.
Yeah. Last thing here, like, you know, we have a texter pointing out that someone on the morning show, one of the morning show hosts, was critical of Zegras. I know you are deeply skeptical.
Look, I think I'm less skeptical than Bruff, who's very skeptical, I believe, of Zegras.
Fair enough.
Because I just don't want to do it for this playoff run.
Fair enough.
If you told me they traded for him at the draft and, like, full court press to get him playing the right way and, like, leaning on all the relationships, hey, I'm in.
Yeah. I just, like, I do think it's worth noting, right, that when you think about recent Stanley Cup winners, there's usually at least a guy who they were able to go get because there was some, you know, usually substantial reason why they were available, right? Mm. So, like, you think about Vegas with Eichel, obviously, but think about Colorado with Kadri. Like, Kadri got suspended every single playoff run, and there was real concern about whether he could be depended on when the emotional stakes of the game were raised. That's why he was available to Colorado for Barry, Kerfoot, plus, right? Tampa's sort of a different matter, right? They just, like, identify the really good, super competitive, undervalued $1 million guys. That's their particular bucket that they like to shop in. But the Blues, Ryan O'Reilly. Like, people forget when the Buffalo Sabres traded Ryan O'Reilly, like, just how much noise was around him, right? He was talking about things like retiring. He'd had the incident with the inebriated driving at Tim Hortons, on and on. Like, most teams have to take a swing on a talented guy who you might be worried about for some, you know, absolutely reasonable reason. And that's the opportunity, like, that I think the Canucks, like, I do think you should pursue something relatively high variance here, especially if you're paying for it, and ideally something locked in.
I would say, though, how many of those were deadline moves, right? Because even, I don't think any of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I do think
summer.
There's something
those
to be
are
said
off-season
for...
moves.
We're taking this swing, but we're giving ourselves the runway to work out the kinks.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And make sure it is a fit and get everyone on the same page. Like, I hear you with, is the talent just too much to pass up on Zegras? I totally get that. It just makes me very, very nervous going in to the trade deadline. That close to the playoffs.
I can appreciate that.
I don't know. But you're right. Like, sometimes if a really, really good player is undervalued for other reasons, you take that swing, it can pay huge, huge dividends for you at some point. 650 here. Final couple of minutes on the show. This text came in. How imperative is it for the Canucks to trade for a scoring winger for Petey to convince Petey to re-sign with the team?
Oh, man. Are we really going through this again?
I don't think that enters into it. Look, does the team winning in the playoffs increase Elias Pettersson's chances of staying? I can't answer that because I don't know what's in his mind, but it can't hurt. So you do it from that for that perspective, it helps. But that's not why you're doing it. You're doing it because you want to win. And any reaction Elias Pettersson might have to that is a bonus. It's not the driving force. You don't say, oh, we got to get this player to please Elias Pettersson. You do it so the team has a chance to win.
Yeah. Look, if we knew what would please Elias Pettersson, or if the team did, right? Surely they would be more advanced in terms of extension talks at this point. You know?
If it was that straightforward.
But man, the amount of people who confidently were like, well, if they don't extend Kuzmenko, you know? It's like, I don't know what matters to him. I don't. So let's not overfit, you know, this mind-reading ability that Canucks fans seem to have about their star player. The team's done what they can. They've put themselves in. They've given themselves a chance to win with this player and take that shot, sort it out in the summer. That's clearly what he's indicated his preference is, and until that changes, I think we should just wood with that as our working theory.
The iconic Coors Light Chill Train is heading to Las Vegas for the big game, and it just made a stop in Vancouver, leaving behind a trail of epic prizes.
A trail of prizes?
On February 1st and 2nd from 8 a.m.
Is that in addition to the dead bodies?
Whoa. Look for its frozen tracks at Robson Square for a chance to win instant prizes that deliver big game day chill or the ultimate grand prize, a trip to next year's big game event. Learn more at CoorsLight.ca/the Chill Train. That's all for us. We're back tomorrow here on Sportsnet 650.